Recording. Okay, so now we're recording. Here's the antitrust policy notice that we show at every meeting. Please take a look at it if you haven't seen it before. And here's our meeting notes. It was linked in the email that you received as a reminder for the call. For those of you who have set up your Linux Foundation ID, you can log into this page and take notes, add yourself in as an attendee. I'll be adding in the attendees as I look down the names. So feel free to do that. Is there anyone who doesn't have their Linux Foundation ID set up and wants some help with that? It's what allows you to engage with this wiki that we have. So let me know. I can send you the instructions. The instructions are also pretty easy to find here. If you go to our wiki.hyperledger.org, you just go to Community Tools, and there's a page there about the Linux Foundation ID. So is there anyone new to the call or who hasn't joined in a while? I don't know if I've met Pat Duffy.
Hi, how's everybody doing?
Hi. Introduce yourself, let us know why you're here and what you do in the blockchain space.
Sure, so we're The Giving Block, and we're a consultancy that works with traditional nonprofits, equipping them to fundraise cryptocurrency, kind of as a primary function. And then we help them with marketing and awareness within that community, and then building and developing partnerships, whether that be creating actual blockchain applications or just partnering with organizations in the space to get the word out.
Awesome, thank you for joining. How did you hear about our group?
So I wish I had a better answer to that question. My business partner actually tipped me off to the call. He had a call running over, so I did jump in and fill in. He hasn't given me the background yet, but I'm excited to hear more.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for joining. Is there anyone else who's new? I think I recognize everyone else other than our speaker, Christina, and the phone number 742. I don't know who you are.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, my name's Corey. I'm in San Francisco. I heard about it. Through Meetup, but also through some research online. I'm very interested in open source and have I really want to make an impact on the world, and I have some really cool people that I've been talking to, and this is exactly what I've been looking for. So I'm interested in just listening in and learning more about it. I'll put it back on mute because it's 7 o'clock here and I'm still in commute. But I'm on mute, but thank you very much.
Thank you for joining so early.
No worries. I'm happy to be here. Looking forward to the call. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Corey. Okay, well, I think that's who we have for now. I'm sure others will join as we go along. So move on with the agenda. One of the important things to focus on today is completing the survey. So this is a survey that we put together. I'm going to highlight the link and add it into our, into our Zoom chat, if I can find the Zoom chat. There we go. So that you can make sure to complete it by the end of today. So if this is the first time you're hearing about the survey, what this survey is about is really to get a sense of the community that's here now. This group started just about a year ago, and it's evolved a lot since then. The people who are participating have evolved a lot since then, and so we really want to get a feel for what the community now is interested in this group focusing on. Since some of you are new to Hyperledger Special Interest Groups, as you all know, the special interest groups, anyone can join. It's a totally open group. There is no barrier to entry. So you can invite any of your friends who are interested in social impact and blockchain. And the group is very community driven. So there's nothing, what we are here at Hyperledger is to really facilitate this open communities activities and conversations, but we don't dictate in any way what you work on. So it's up to the group to decide what you want the output of your the discussions, the meetings, the efforts of this group to be. In a two meetings ago, to kind of give people a sense of what special interest groups do, you can take a look at our meeting notes. I'll show you here for those who are not familiar. So in our June 25th meeting, we talked about what are some of the other special interest groups working on. So some of them have these different project proposals. The supply chain group, public sector is doing a white paper. Healthcare has all these different subgroups. Identity is doing a white paper. Not included on here is telecom, which is also doing a white paper. So there's a lot of different things that this group can focus on. And obviously social impact is a pretty broad topic, encompassing a lot of different sectors. And so we wanted to see if we can narrow it down a bit and find out what the participants here want to work on. Do we want to focus on some topics around digital identity or remittances or what have you? So please take a minute to fill out the survey and include your input into what will be the direction that this group goes in the future. Any questions on the survey? Sorry, I'm just getting over a cold. So another thing I wanted to announce is also the opportunity for an upcoming chair. So generally a chair serves for about a year term. We had Rick and Alyssa kind of spearhead this group from the beginning, Rick especially in the beginning as well. Alyssa's been here throughout the year, taking it forward, working together with me. And we're now at a point where we need a new SIG chair. I'll be posting information on what the election process is going to be like. Absolutely anyone can nominate themselves. You just have to be interested in taking on this role. And so I'm including here generally what chairs are responsible for, so that if it's something you're thinking about, you can have an idea of what it entails. We also are suggesting a new sort of chair makeup at Hyperledger, where a chair can pick a vice chair so that whenever the chair is not available or they can share their tasks amongst each other. So it's the same tasks here. They can just decide how they divide it up amongst themselves, but the chair can have someone else who's there to work with them in leading the group. And something to keep in mind is the chairs at Hyperledger are not dictating what the group is doing. They're really like pilots, leading the group where the group wants to go. It doesn't mean you have to be involved in all the activities. Other people can take leads on certain topics. but you are sort of the main point person for the group. So if that's something you're interested in, please reach out to me. And again, I'll be sending some more information about how that process is going to take place over the next couple weeks. Any questions on that? It's a quiet group today. It's all the heat. So next we have a presentation from Christina, and I believe Christina is on. I saw her earlier. Christina is the blockchain lead at UNICEF, and she's going to share with us what projects and activities they're doing in blockchain. Christina, I can stop sharing my screen, and then you can feel free to share yours if you need to.
Perfect. One moment. Can everyone see my screen?
Yes, I see it.
Perfect. So hi everyone, my name is Christina Lomanzo. I'm the blockchain lead at UNICEF. We are a group within the innovation team really meant to explore how new technologies can help UNICEF deliver on its mission. And today I'll walk you through a little bit about the work that we do. But before we do that, I just wanted to start with some background in case you're not familiar with UNICEF. UNICEF is an organization with 190 different offices around the world, a quite large budget, so $7.7 billion a year, and staff around the world, with 88% of our staff in the field. We're celebrating our 72nd birthday this year, and work in a lot of different emergencies. Two of my favorite facts about UNICEF is that we are one of the world's largest procurer of vaccines. So we buy about 34% of the world's vaccines. We've also vaccinated the first baby last year, via drone delivery in Vanuatu. That was part of our innovation team. And lastly, that we're the largest single procurer of pencils in the world. So with that being said, I wanted to give you a little bit of background on our blockchain work. So our innovation team has been exploring blockchain since 2015 with our first experimentation around digital ID on the Bitcoin blockchain. And then from there, really exploring different types of blockchains and their applications, starting to explore education in some of our program countries, and then some of our national committees, which are the fundraising arms of UNICEF. So in countries like Canada, US, Europe, Japan, Australia, those would be considered national committees. Some of those national committees now accept crypto. So having said all that, I wanted to do a little bit of a deep dive into some of the projects that we're working on, and then get to questions, which is my favorite part. So UNICEF France was our first national committee to accept crypto. They started doing this in 2018 when a company called Game Changers approached them and offered them the opportunity to do a campaign together. And essentially what Game Changer was to get gamers who had gaming consoles to run software when they weren't using their gaming console. And what would happen is that package of software would then mine crypto, and that crypto would then go to UNICEF France. And at that time, there was a campaign around Syrian refugee children. And so then the funds would then be used out in the field. And so the first campaign went quite well. It raised about 85 ETH, which at the time was about $15,000 that was raised. There are still Game Changer software mining crypto and donating to UNICEF France even today. And France now accepts about 9 different types of crypto. And of course, all of that's public, so you can go and find their public address and look up where they're using some of that crypto. One of the really interesting things is I'm going to talk to you about a project shortly called Project Connect, but UNICEF France actually used the crypto in crypto by putting up a bounty. So they essentially took 10 ETH This was back in May, and incentivized developers from around the world to create smart contracts and essentially work for this bounty, and one team was ultimately chosen and paid out in crypto. And so that was really nice to see crypto come in and crypto go out. Often what we see with organizations who accept crypto is that they convert that directly into fiat. And so this was a nice example of keeping crypto crypto. The next thing I wanted to talk to you about was around certificates. And so this project actually started from, we have drone corridors in Vanuatu, Malawi, and Kazakhstan currently. And we do different types of drone testing. So some are for vaccine delivery, some are for emergency response, some are for medical purposes. And one of the challenges that they had in the drone corridor was actually incentivizing some of these companies to come and test their drones and giving them public recognition for essentially the service that they were doing by testing their drones and being prepared for emergencies. And so one of the suggestions was to create a certificate. And so you can see on this slide, this is the certificate that they proposed in Kazakhstan. And the feedback that we got from the team was certificates are really nice, but they're also very easy to forge. And what does a certificate actually get someone? And so what we did is we built this platform called certificates.dignity.network that you can go to. It's open and public. And we actually published all of the credentials and certificates on the Ethereum blockchain. And so it's verifiable by anyone. These companies no longer need to come to us to actually verify that these credentials are valid. And now what they're used for is that these companies who flew their drones in Kazakhstan can now go to Malawi or Vanuatu and prove that they've participated in a UNICEF drone corridor. And what we see is that over time, these drone companies are going to be building essentially a reputation, an informal reputation that they're then able to leverage. And while that may not be super significant to drone companies, that starts to be very significant when you're talking about a Syrian refugee who's returning home after 5 years of spending time in Jordan and taking various different educational credentials. And so after we did the Kazakhstan certificates, we prototyped this with a group here in New York. I was co-teaching a class at NYU on blockchain, and so we issued certificates there. And now we're looking to expand this to various use cases out in the field to actually issue these digital credentials to individuals.
And sorry, Christine, I missed it. The certificates are for what exactly? For the drone itself, that it's a valid drone?
So it's for the drone company that they participated in the drone corridor.
Okay, so for a drone that's participated in that specific.
Yeah, so we've set up these regulatory zones essentially where, so in many countries it's hard to fly a drone or you fly a drone and then you find out you've flown it at the wrong spot. We have actual parcels of land that are designated for testing. And so we have, you know, higher airspace, let's say, than in other areas. It's really designed for drone testing. And so when companies come in and test in that drone corridor, then we can certify that they were actually in that corridor and doing testing on a certain day.
I see. And when does that sort of check take place? Is it while it's being flown or afterwards?
So it's on the day of. There's a team of people who are out there with the drones, and they personally verify that there's a tag on the drone, certify that belongs to the person from the company, and that's how the certificate is then issued. First via PDF, and then the PDF is issued on chain.
Okay, very cool, very cool.
Yeah. So next project is really around connectivity, which seems a little bit strange for blockchain, but it'll make sense in a second. So UNICEF has this project called Project Connect, and this really looks to first map all the schools in a country, and then secondly, to determine the internet connectivity speed of those schools. Most people will say, well, don't governments know where their schools are? Most of the time, yes, but sometimes no. Data sets can be wrong. And so using a variety of machine learning and algorithms, we actually can sometimes find schools. So in the case of Columbia, the map you're seeing right now, when we did school mapping, we found 1,000 schools that the Ministry of Education wasn't aware of before we did the mapping. And while we see this as a map of connectivity, a lot of my teammates in the innovation team see this as where you need to go in the time of an emergency, because there's low connectivity in those red areas. Some people see it as where viruses will spread and epidemics. And so it actually gives us a lot more information than at first glance. And so green is about 3G, you can think of it that way, yellow 2G, red no G, and purple we don't have any data on. And so what we're looking to do is both map the schools and bring them online. And you can even go to the level of actually clicking on a school and getting some data about it. But what we wanted to confirm is that if we were paying to bring a school online, how do you know that connectivity has actually been provided to that school? And how do you know that the green dots that claim to be 3G are actually 3G? And this becomes really important when you start to think about large donors and providing a lot of money and transparency in donations. And so we've started to do some prototypes both in Colombia and in Kyrgyzstan, where we've sent probes, so little devices into schools, essentially connected into laptops, that are taking a daily internet reading of the speed in that school. And what it's doing is it's writing directly on chain. And so what you can see on this slide here is from one of the schools in Kyrgyzstan, where we're actually tracking the daily internet connectivity speed. And we know that no one has tampered with that connectivity speed because it's being written directly on chain from a device in that school. And so what we imagine long-term is that you'll be able to have transparency of both monies coming in to provide connectivity for a region. You'll be able to track the connectivity of a certain region or of a certain school on a daily basis. But you could also have smart contracts that manage the relationship with the internet service provider. So for example, if internet connectivity is not provided, let's say 10 days out of 30 days in a month, perhaps there's a secondary internet service provider who should take over that contract because that hasn't met the service level requirements for that region. And so this prototype is still in the earliest stages, but we do have prototypes so far in 2 countries, and we'll be looking to expand this across all of Kyrgyzstan in the fall. Any questions on that project?
Oh, okay. I just find that absolutely fascinating that the Ministry of Education don't know about that many schools.
Yeah, it actually happens. There was another country in northwestern Africa that when we plotted the data that the government had given us, we found that over half the schools actually ended up being plotted in the ocean. So it happens more frequently than you would imagine.
And so that was a question I had. So if the government didn't have the data, how did you get the data of the schools that had zero connectivity?
How do we get the data about what, sorry?
The schools that had zero connectivity.
So what we're doing in that case is we have a data science team within our innovation team, and they're using a series of data sets that have been provided to us. So think of big data sets like Google, Facebook, telecommunication providers. Mm-hmm. And then we also have satellite imagery. Mm-hmm. And so we're running a whole bunch of algorithms to actually determine. It's pretty easy from a satellite map to determine what a school looks like. They have very similar characteristics, even country to country. And so we're using a whole bunch of algorithms and machine learning to actually determine where the schools are.
Okay.
One of the cool things is that when we mapped all the schools in Kyrgyzstan, the government actually realized that a lot of their schools weren't connected. And because they had the visibility and the data in front of them, they actually committed to bringing those schools online. And so now I think they're about halfway through bringing the rest of the schools that didn't have connectivity speed online. And I mean, connectivity really determines a lot of things. We used connectivity of a school as an indicator of the connectivity of that community. Uh-huh. And it also determines how you deliver education to that school as well, right? If you have a school that doesn't have any internet connectivity speed, there's no use in providing digital tools for that school. So ultimately what we're looking to do is really use like crypto coming in to provide transparency in the donation when we get to that point, because UNICEF currently doesn't deal in crypto, only our national committees. And then ultimately use smart contracts to be really transparent about how we're managing the contract with the internet service providers. Make sense?
Yeah.
Great. One other program that we launched almost a year ago now is a program called Surge. And Surge is an initiative to educate young people about blockchain. And so what we typically find is that, you know, there's obviously a limited amount of blockchain developers, given that blockchain is relatively new, especially for blockchains that require specific libraries or coding knowledge, like Solidity, for example. And so what we've looked to do is actually enable local communities to build local solutions. Building something in New York and then trying to bring it out into Zaatari camp, that doesn't have a very high success rate. What does have a high success rate is enabling local communities to solve local problems. And so Surge essentially does two things. One is learning events where we'll go in and either do a technical or non-technical introduction to blockchain, depending on the group. And sometimes we'll follow that up with a hackathon, essentially bringing together mentors and community leaders to solve a problem. And so we've had topics like identity, refugee crisis, financial inclusion, and we've done this in countries like South Africa, in Thailand, in Kazakhstan. So this photo here was from Cape Town in April when we did a learning event. These individuals you see in the picture had no idea what blockchain or crypto was at the beginning of the day. They came because they were part of a coding program, brand new to programming, and their mentor had told them that blockchain had a huge potential. They were pretty big skeptics at the beginning of the day. Yeah. But by the end of the day, they were so excited about crypto and blockchain. And we had them set up their first wallets. We had them interact with their first blockchain application and fulfill a bounty. And so it was really exciting to kind of kick off their blockchain learning journey. And so we'll be doing a series of these events over the rest of 2019 and into 2020.
And
so
with some of these events, so is there any sort of follow-up afterwards? So, you know, this is something that exposes them, and then I wonder, you know, what they feel like they can work on next or do next or build on top of what they learn at your Surge events.
Yeah, so one of the closing items that we always have at Surge workshops is how the individuals can continue to learn and can get connected into the local ecosystem in their community. And so one of the closing session in Cape Town, we had the Accelerator Lab come in and give a talk not only about the Accelerator Labs, but the local meetups that were being run in Cape Town in the blockchain space. And then we left them with a list of online resources that they could go and explore. One of the really nice things about what happened in Cape Town was we actually held this event at a larger hackathon with people who were very deep into the blockchain space. And they heard about these group of young people who were learning about blockchain for the first time. And the hackers decided to pool some crypto to actually put towards this group of individuals' future blockchain learning. And so they set up a wallet on the spot. They sent it around to the 100 people that were at the hackathon and actually raised a nice chunk of crypto to then pass back to the coding school so that these young people could continue their blockchain education by having someone come back and do that. So we use various mechanisms. We also use ongoing bounties. So we introduce them to a wallet and bounties during the workshop. And then we leave bounties up afterwards. That encourages them to want to continue their blockchain learning. And we'll ask them really specific things, like one of the ongoing tasks was with DAI and stablecoins and figuring out how to set up a DAI storefront. And once they do that, they prove that they've gone through the steps of figuring out how to do a storefront. They don't actually have to launch it. And then they'll get rewarded with a few DAI for doing that. And so there's an incentive mechanism afterwards to keep them learning. Mm-hmm. So what we really hope, though, for those groups is that they both learn and they learn enough there, but are also inspired to start their own projects, because UNICEF has an innovation fund. And so it's about a $20 million fund where we invest in early stage startups from emerging or developing economies. And we provide up to $100,000 of non-equity financing and a year of mentorship when these companies are chosen. And so we don't just do this in blockchain, we do this across a few different tech verticals. And what we're really looking for is the intersection between a $100 billion industry and about a billion person need. And so we right now have investments in virtual reality, in drones, in data science companies, in accessibility companies, and most recently, a blockchain cohort of investments. So back in December of 2018, we made 6 investments. We invested in ATIX Labs, who are based in Argentina. They're really an impact funding platform. And what I mean by that is they find funders who want to fund a particular project. And then they use smart contracts to tranche the funding and release the funding only when milestones are met. You have OneSmart, who have now renamed themselves to OS City, in case you're looking them up. They're from Mexico, and they really work on data transparency. And so they've worked with governments in Chile, Argentina, and Mexico around putting data front and center so that citizens can hold their governments accountable. They worked on a project, I believe it was in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, where your bus fare was based on how late the bus was. And this was all blockchain enabled. So if the bus showed up 5 minutes late, then you got some type of discount for doing that. The bus showed up on time, you pay a regular fare. So that was one of the really cool applications from OS City. Prescripto, who's based in Mexico, they're really around digital prescriptions and putting those on chain. They've issued, or doctors have now issued over 150,000 digital prescriptions in Mexico. And one of the things that does is that it gives the individual back the ability to own their data rather than passing over all of that information to pharmacies that then own essentially your entire prescription history and can sell that to pharmaceutical companies or research companies. So that's Prescripto. Then we have Statwig. They're based in India and they really do vaccine supply chain. And so they look at, through the entire journey of a vaccine, it's meant to stay within a certain temperature range. Using blockchain essentially to track that and provide that information across the multiple stakeholders who need that information. Then there's W3, they're based in Bangladesh. They are doing mobile connectivity. And what I mean by this is if you have a gig of data and you know that you only need 500 megs, you can actually resell the balance of 500 megs and megabytes by tokenizing that. And then through a mesh network, reselling that to people in your local community. And so they're particularly focusing on refugee camps and providing connectivity in refugee camps where someone might have connectivity and can then share that with the folks around them. And lastly, UtoPixar, which is based in Tunisia, they're really creating a community platform where different communities can come together, create tokens and make decisions together. So particularly experimenting with DAOs or distributed autonomous organizations around, if you had a small pool of money as a community, collectively deciding where that money gets spent in a very transparent way. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of going to leave it there, but really happy to answer any questions. And if you would like to learn more at all, we do have a ton of resources online. We tend to publish an article about everything that we're working on. We try and be as transparent as possible with all of our work. So feel free to check out our website or to drop us an email. I have access to that email.
Thanks, Christina. It was amazing to see all of that. Just a couple of questions out of interest. So what do you see at UNICEF as being, what's the right question, the way to say it? What do you see as the most exciting opportunity in this space right now? Or what would you like to see as the that isn't being done that you think has the biggest value?
So I think that's a great question. I think there's a lot going on, particularly within the UN system. And the difficulty that we're facing right now is because the UN is such a large organization, sometimes it's hard to find out what's already been done, or we're starting from scratch and not leveraging each other's work as much as we should, especially given the open nature of blockchain. And so I think the thing that I'm most excited about, and it's a project that I didn't have any slides on, so I didn't mention, but we've just launched a project called the Atrium, which is a project launched under the UN Innovation Network umbrella. And if you are interested in UN innovation, it's open to anyone to join. So I'd encourage you to, it's uninnovation.network is their website. You can sign up for their newsletter. But us and the World Food Program have just launched a project called the Atrium, which is essentially a GitHub repository storefront with an underlying blockchain where people can go and experiment and share code across the UN, so that if WFP wanted to do certificates, they don't need to start from scratch because they know that we've already done that. And that actually was the first use case, was WFP coming to us and saying, we want to issue digital certificates. We know you've already done that. Can we use the code? And we uploaded our code onto the storefront, which is now accessible to anyone within the UN. And they reduced the development time by 80% by leveraging the code that we had already developed. So for me, that's what's really exciting, is developing these applications and then sharing it across organizations.
Interesting. So do you, so with that, with just thinking out loud as you said that, then what would your view be on kind of this, the our SIG working group? You know, what do you see as the potential that as a group in the social impact space could be, helping an organization like the UN? Sorry, UNICEF.
Yeah, that's a big question. I think one of them, so I've participated in a few SIG meetings over the last year, not as many as I would like. But one of the things that really struck me was, you know, how much knowledge that each participant coming to the meeting has, and being able to, you know, bring that together in one place is so helpful, not just for UNICEF, but for, you know, the industry at large. I'm sure most people have seen the Stanford Social Impact paper, which is a compilation from like 3, maybe 4 years ago now, of what blockchain projects there were in the social impact space, divided into different areas like agriculture or energy, so on and so forth. For me, things like that are super valuable because it provides a little bit of legitimacy to the space, especially within a system like the UN, where they're looking to external groups to kind of point and say, hey, there's stuff that's going on, and other people should pay attention.
Interesting. Cool, thank you.
No problem, thanks.
Christina, you mentioned, thank you again for the presentation, it was very helpful. You mentioned something in 2015 about a digital ID. Could you elaborate on that project?
Yeah, so I don't have a ton to share because I wasn't around back in 2015. Where you can read about it is there was an MIT paper published, and I can share this with Karen and she can share it with the rest of the group. There's an MIT paper published last summer about our work on blockchain. It was essentially back in 2015, one of our programmers decided to essentially take photos, hash it, and put it on the Bitcoin blockchain. And while that worked really fine doing that in our office, what we realized when we tried to bring that out to scale was that it just wasn't viable to assume that A, there was connectivity out in the field, B, that people would have handheld devices, C, that people would know how to use a blockchain application. I mean, it's still difficult to use blockchain apps in today's day and age. So in 2015, that was like, you were like a super nerd if you knew how to work it back in 2015. So it just wasn't ready for adoption. And it was also, we have design principles that we generally follow, which one is build with the user. And we didn't build with the user for that use case specifically. We built it in a bubble. And so that didn't work for us.
Thank you. The reason why I asked is of the social development goals, I think it was 16.9. It really, that social development goal is trying to provide a legal identity for all. And there has been some, I guess, some human rights issues and particularly around privacy. And so on the identity working group within Hyperledger, we're actually trying to figure out the best possible way to make it. There may be like 3 or 5 good DIDs, identity startups. Some of them aren't necessarily startups, but platforms. And so, you know, choosing one versus multiple, using biometrics. So it seems that identity, everybody's, at least from the presentations that I've heard on the identity working group size, that have focused on, for example, refugees or the 5 million that are unconnected, or 5 billion that are unconnected. You know, the identity seems, it always comes back to identity in some form or fashion. So it'll be interesting to see how that unravels. But thank you for providing this valuable information on UNICEF.
Yeah, no problem. And I think you're completely right. I mean, digital ID is the golden nugget that everyone is chasing after. It's just unfortunately the most complicated of the nuggets to kind of figure out at the same time. I don't know that there's any one group who has really cracked it yet, but I'm always very keen to learn, the progress that's being made on that front, because it will have such an impact when solved.
Yeah. Hi. I can ask you a quick question. This is Mark. I'm with UN Volunteers, and I was just curious, having worked on the UN Principles on Personal Data Privacy and Protection, I know that each agency has to sort of come up with their own policies around that, but what data privacy protections they undertook in some of the innovations that UNICEF was involved in? And secondly, what do you think is the next step in sort of like a multi-agency or multi-sectoral platform and sort of cross-collaboration going forward? Thank you.
So on the first question around data privacy, we follow the UNICEF data privacy policies. So always keeping that front and center and working with our ethics office as well. So for example, we wanted to join the Humanity DAO as an experiment and went and got clearance from our ethics office before doing that. A lot of our projects don't deal with personal data as much, but when we do, we make sure to comply with the UNICEF rules and policies on that. In terms of cross-agency collaboration, I would go back to the UN Innovation Network is 1,500 people from around the world who are interested in innovation, some of them interested in blockchain, and using the UN Innovation Network as a collaboration mechanism is very powerful. And from a blockchain perspective, Obviously, the Atrium project that I mentioned is what we hope that will at least give the opportunity for individuals to dip their toe into experimenting with blockchain and lower the barrier for any agency to be able to learn more and share with other agencies.
Hi. Hi, Christina. Hi. This is Alfonso Govela from Mexico. Thank you very much for an extraordinary presentation. We've worked with UNICEF very successfully. We love what you do, and what you presented is really, really interesting. I'd like to ask you, you talked about Atrium, okay, and the GitHub the repository, but is there an equivalent site where not only coders, but people interested in social impact, not knowing about coding, can come? Because something we've found here in Blockchain Mérida is that it's not easy to bring together whomever wants to do things, okay, with whomever has the knowledge to do them, both ways. So is there an equivalent to your Atrium GitHub for coders, for people wanting to do social impact things?
Yeah, so at least in the blockchain space, so for Atrium, we're trying to build, so we're not, though it is the back end will be a GitHub that stores everything, we're building a UI that's more consumable to, for example, project managers or what we dub innovators who might not be, you know, a coder, but are interested in learning what's going on. So we are trying to develop that to be friendly to both audiences. In terms of more generally outside of the blockchain space, there's currently a project going on within the UN called Digital Public Goods. And if I'm not mistaken, it's digitalpublicgoods.net, where you can see the website or the first prototype of that. And what that's really meant to do, at least at a government level, is to provide different governments with one place to go where there's been open source software packages that have been vetted that a government can reliably go to and feel comfortable using at a national level. And so that's still relatively in the early phases, but that is an effort that is currently underway.
Thank you.
No problem. Okay, seems like that's it.
I have another question. So I think we were both at the Blockchain for Impact event at the UN in June.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you said, you know, the UN is really disparate and so people are doing different things and it's hard to coordinate. Is the Blockchain for Impact conference, is that sort of an effort to bring that coordination about? Is there anything that that group does outside of that conference during the year that we should know about?
So that blockchain, are you talking about the June 4th event?
Yes, I think, yes.
So that's not a, yeah, so that conference actually isn't a UN organization who does that. They're an outside organization that calls themselves Blockchain for Impact, if I'm not mistaken. And they then bring together different actors, I believe, once a year. I'm not super familiar with their work, so as far as I understand, their summit on a yearly basis is really their big event, and then they do a few events around the UN General Assembly in September. In terms of staying connected on what's going on with the UN and blockchain, the UN Innovation Network, for me, is the easiest way to learn about what's going on. They send out quarterly updates about all the innovation that's going on, but each agency submits an update quarterly. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, like the update that's from my team that's going in there this quarter is you would learn about Atrium, and Atrium would be in that update. So that's like something new that's happened in the last 3 months. Before that, you would have learned about our Surge events because that's when it launched. So the UN Innovation Network for me is the easiest way. there are sometimes some one-off events that are hosted by different agencies bringing people together. But that's, the prime way really is the UN Innovation Network, at least from my perspective.
Okay, well, that's helpful to confirm, because that was sort of the sense that I got, that it's just an event per year and there really isn't much that happens with that.
Yeah.
Or that group or whoever it is outside of it. And so to stay up to date with UN Innovation, that's uninnovation.network?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I just want to make sure I got that in the notes.
We're also pretty active on Twitter as well. So UNICEF Innovate, that's at the bottom of the screen. Every time we post an article or issue a new article about what we're working on, our Twitter account will also post that. So you can get even more real time what's going on, at least with our work.
Okay, awesome. We have a few extra minutes. Anyone else? Last questions for Christina? Well, it's awesome to have you on the call. Thank you so much for taking the time to present to us, Christina, and we hope to see you on our calls in the future whenever you can join and contribute to our survey as well on what you think would be good for this group to work on. You had some good ideas earlier when Kane asked you that. So we'd love to have your involvement and participation.
Really happy to. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And also thank you for all the questions. Those are always my favorite. So thank you to everyone.
Since we have a minute left, Andrea, I know that you had suggested being a liaison with the Identity Working Group. Could you just share a little bit about, so that the group's aware of what you're doing with that? You had sent a message on chat about it, but I wanted to make sure that you shared about it with the larger group here as well.
Sure. So I also sit on the Identity Working Group, and we meet quite frequently, and they're undergoing some, I think they're rolling up the Indy Working Group. But what I found over time on sitting on both the Social Impact Group and the Identity Working Group, there wasn't much, kind of like the UN, it's better to know what everybody else is doing. So there wasn't any duplicative work. And I recall, I think someone bringing up, let's do an identity working paper. I said, well, why don't we just, piggyback on the Identity Working Group's white paper that they've all been working on. But so after talking to Vipin, who chairs that working group, he mentioned, why don't you just, if you want, become the liaison between the two, and if there's any information sharing that you can provide either of us, then just keep us up to date. And I said, sure, that's quite an easy task for me to do, and I said I'd be welcome to do that. So, and the purpose of the Identity Working Group, of course, is to discuss and research and document ways to capture, store, and transmit the use of identities, and so. It seems that, for example, one of the past most recent speakers was talking about identification of refugees. And I think they were 2 billion was their target, which is quite rather large. So I go, well, that's a pretty lofty goal. But then the question that I asked Christina was, it was really just interesting to see how everyone's tackling identity. And as she mentioned, it's the gold nugget. I think everybody's trying to race towards that because it really is the key, or is one of the keys into unlocking some of the other social development goals that the UN has laid out of the 17. So I'm happy to act as that liaison between the Social Impact Group and the Identity Group.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Andres, for volunteering to do that. We can have others do that with other SIGs. Bobby also acts as a liaison as well with some of the other groups She attends a lot of the other groups' meetings. But if there's any other group that you're already in or interested in participating in and you want to just be someone who kind of shares, like, hey, this is what is going on in the supply chain SIG, for example, and that relates to a topic we're doing here on, you know, could be like coffee supply chain, health and labor practices or whatever it is. That type of thing would be interesting to have.
Hey, Karen, it's Bobby.
Hi, Bobby.
I know that the social impact special interest group at the next meeting, Drummond Reed is giving scheduled to give a presentation on identity management. So if anybody wants to, it's a Friday, 10:00 Eastern time. So that might be an interesting presentation for some of us to listen in on.
Which group was that? You said social impact.
Oh, I'm sorry, the public sector.
Public sector, okay.
Public sector, sorry.
Okay. Will you share a link on that with the group?
No problem.
Or add it to the meeting notes?
No problem. I'll put it in the chat right now.
Thank you. Okay, so we're at time. Thanks so much, everybody, for joining. Thank you so much, Christina, for presenting and sharing about what's going on at UNICEF. Don't forget to fill out the survey. We're going to start looking at the responses after the end of today. It'll just take you a few minutes. And I look forward to engaging with you all online, hearing what you're looking at working on this group. I'm excited to look at the responses. And we'll talk in 2 weeks.
Thanks, everyone.
Have a great rest of the day.
Appreciate it. Thank you.